Thanks for listening to Exploring the Wine Glass podcast, the podcast for people who love wine. I'm Lori Budd, a UC Davis winemaking program and WSET Level 2 graduate. You can find Exploring the Wine Glass on all the socials, as well as your favorite podcast catchers. If you haven't subscribed yet, now's the perfect time. I promise I'll never tell you what to drink, but I'll always share what's in my glass. Today on the podcast, I sit down with Katie Madigan. Katie is the rock star winemaker for St. Francis Winery in Santa Rosa, California. Her name may not be known in every wine lover's household today, but I know we will be hearing more great things about her in the upcoming years. We sat down and discussed how she went from a chemistry major at UC Santa Barbara to being named Female Winemaker of the Year. We also talked through four wines in her portfolio. I didn't have the time to taste them as they arrived directly before the interview, but after our conversation, I cannot wait to pop the corks on them. As you are listening, if you could please take the time to scroll through to rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts. I have no idea why, but it's the reviews that matter in the iTunes algorithm to help get Exploring the Wine Glass suggested to more people. So enjoy the conversation. Sláinte. Hey, everybody. Welcome to this episode of Dracaena Wines on Wine. And as you know, in these episodes, I sit down one-on-one with a person in the wine industry. And basically what we do is we explore as we pour. And we are going to be talking today to Katie Madigan of St. Francis Winery. So hi, Katie.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it is an honor. I have to say that my husband Mike and I, we visited St. Francis like when we first got into wine, and it was one of our favorite wineries, and to this day it still is. We love the wines, we love the winery. There's so much history there. It's just incredible. So it's like really an honor to be talking to you and being able to share the wines of St. Francis with everybody who listens or watches. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. You know, we have been around since the 70s, and I think I know so many people that have been to our winery many years ago. And so for me to kind of step in as this new generation, an already successful winery, and still see it flourish has been a lot of fun for me as well. Yeah.
And I am going to throw something. You've been there a long time, but like, was it kind of nerve-wracking to take the reins of such a well-known and established winery?
It was incredibly nerve-wracking, and even though I had been assistant and an associate for well over 8 years studying under our original winemaker, to take over for someone that was coined the Master of Merlot was no small feat, and at such a young age, I definitely knew, you know, literally and figuratively, I had big shoes to fill. Tom is a very tall man. So.
All right, so let's get into, how did you actually get into the wine industry? Did you grow up around it? Like, where did you grow up?
I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, so not too far from wine country, about an hour south. But really, it was my parents. They were really into wine while I was growing up, and their favorite thing to do was visit wine country. They always said when they sent the kids off to college, their dream was to retire here, and that is what they did. So when I left my studies down in Santa Barbara, I actually thought I would move up here, be closer to my family, and I just kind of fell in love that people worked in this industry. I wasn't aware that this was something you could do as a career.
And a very good career, or I should say a very fun career, very fun career. So you actually went to UC Santa Barbara for chemistry. So was wine on your mind as a chemist, as a freshman, or were you thinking something else? Because my husband is a food chemist, and I'm a microbiologist, and we're now in the wine industry, and that's not where we thought we were going.
Right. I mean, yeah, even back then, there were only two schools that were really focused on winemaking. So when I was at Santa Barbara, I think I really liked pharmaceutical science. I've always loved to create things. And so in organic chemistry, when we started going into those kinds of principles, I thought that maybe that was something that I wanted to explore. But as you and your husband very well know, the thought of being locked away in some windowless lab for the rest of my life was a very big possibility, and that was something that I was not interested in. So I started to take some time off, and that's when I moved up north to Sonoma and really see what other options there were. And I took an internship really to see what it was all about. I heard that they had a functional lab in wineries, and yet people were outside half the day. So, I mean, I wanted to see what that was about, and it was way, way more than I could have ever expected.
Yeah, so the windowless lab is so true. So I, as a microbiologist, I actually started my career as a microbiologist in a lab, and it drove me crazy. Yeah. And when people say, well, why don't you do that anymore? I'm always like, I'm way too hyper to be in a lab and under a hood and gloved up and worrying about, it was way, way too much. I needed to get out of there. So I completely understand, completely understand. It was a wonderful experience and the worst experience on the face of the earth. I mean, I used to actually compete against myself on a daily basis. So I would have to set up petri dishes, right, to sample, and sometimes on the slew of like 500 or 600 petri dishes. So I would go to work, and then in the morning I would set up, you have to write on them and you have to set them up by how the dilutions are. And I would set them all up in the morning, and then I would go to lunch, and then I'd come back from lunch and I would set a stopwatch, and I would like micropipette out as fast as I could. And each day, yes, personal best. And everybody else in the lab is looking at me like I'm insane. And I'm like, no, I need to get out of here.
Yeah. I mean, there's something about, start going to work when it's dark and then leaving when it's sunset and never feeling like you got to, see the outside, let alone be outside. So I still love lab work. I'm still fascinated by all that stuff. But I'm very, very thankful that when they built this winery, they built it with plenty of windows and a skylight.
There you
That I get my time in the vineyards. That certainly helps.
That is wonderful. That is wonderful. So you mentioned about the internship at St. Francis, or you did an internship, and it happened to be at St. Francis. So that always intrigues me. How, from UC Santa Barbara, how did you find out about the internship at St. Francis? Like, what's the process of becoming an intern for a winery?
Well, when I moved up here, I was kind of looking at available jobs, and it just so happened that it was in the summertime, and so you were seeing a lot of the available jobs were internships, and I had no idea what that really entailed, but I knew that the requirements fit my background, so I went into the interview not really knowing what it was going to be like at all, and it was an interesting interview. Tom Mackey, our original winemaker, he pretty much grilled me of my wet chemistry skills and how much I knew about fermentation science. And, as a very young, I was 21 at the time, I thought, oh my gosh, this is serious business. So I took the job knowing that I would be in a lab format with some production jobs and duties. But when I got hired, I was one of 10 interns from all over the world. And I soon realized that I had no real reason for anxiety because we were a group of people around the same age that were all experiencing harvest for the first time. And we all had the same questions and learning curves. So I think that made that harvest so much easier for me.
While realizing that you're not alone.
Right, that I wasn't expected to know how to run a pump my first year or, you know, overfill a barrel or, you know, things like that that I definitely made mistakes on, but that it wasn't the end of the world. I didn't ruin this wine because it's part of, you know, being an intern is learning how wineries like their work to be done, their particular style. Mm-hmm. And it also gives you a glimpse on all the different kinds of styles that there are in winemaking. And that I really, really loved.
That's fantastic. So I am a true believer that winemaking is a combination of art and science. And in your bio, you say that winemaking is a perfect combination of science and creativity, which is a much more eloquent way of saying what I say. The science part, I think, is pretty obvious to everybody. There is a lot of chemistry. There is a lot of science into winemaking. But how do you see winemaking as the ability or the outlet to express your creativity?
Yeah, you know, a question that I get frequently, and I'm sure you have come across it as well, is people ask me, has winemaking become a formula? I think it's really quite the opposite. You know, every single vintage is different, no matter how much you know, no matter how much you plan. And I am both of those things. I'm out in the vineyard all year long. I plan as much as humanly possible. But no vintage is ever the same. And instead of looking at it with apprehension, I look at it as another chance to make this vintage the best that it possibly can be. Even when we go through difficult conditions, I still think that the thought that I can make really fantastic wine out of a difficult vintage is one of the proudest moments as a winemaker. And it's those moments that, like, bursts my creativity and really shows me that there's a ton of different ways that you can make wine.
I say to people all the time, the feeling when, and we're small, so it's probably similar, but not quite the same, is when you can see your wines on a shelf. We're just selling basically direct to consumer. We're in restaurants and things like that. But when somebody takes that time to take a picture of our wine and post it, the words can't even explain, you know. And
oh, absolutely. Yes.
That's like your masterpiece, your Monet or, you know, your Picasso, and somebody is appreciating it, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, as you well know, that doesn't come because you followed some spelled out plan. Yeah. It comes from you paying attention during each and every vintage and having your focus consistent, and that those wines may not taste the same year to year, but if someone's taking a picture of your wine and thinks that it's great year after year, that's creative.
Right.
You know, that's showing creativity for sure.
Right. And you had said you plan the most that you can, and then oops, a rainstorm is coming in. Or, yeah.
I mean, I feel like every time I say I've seen it all, I feel like that's the kiss of death because that's something I haven't seen happen.
Right, you almost don't want to say something because
you just got to welcome it with open arms and know that you have the experience to deal with whatever is going to be thrown at you in that harvest time, so.
And I think you need to be quick on your feet. And
yeah.
Now I'm not talking like millisecond, but you need to be able to see something potentially happening and be able to stop going that path and say, oh, okay, I need to go that. And that is pure creativity. That's pure.
Absolutely.
That's pure.
Yeah.
That's not, no matter how much you can do molecular science or, you know, organic chemistry wise, that doesn't help you when something like that happens.
Absolutely.
So that internship actually was like huge, pivotal for you, because you have been at St. Francis since the get-go, right? You started off as a senior lab in 2003, a lab tech in 2003. You were promoted to assistant winemaker in 2006, which I almost fell off the chair because A, that's super fast, and B, not to put in a whole other realm into this, but you're a female, and we tend to be kind of in the wine industry. It's very often, you know, you don't really get, you know, going that quickly. But then you were you working and attending at UC Davis? Because you said in your bio, there's a mention of you graduating from UC Davis. So was that all going on at the same time?
It was all going on at the same time, and, you know, I think really with the questions of what I wanted to do in my major when I was in Santa Barbara, and then coming up here for my first harvest and having the proverbial light bulb go off and knowing that this is what I wanted to do, I knew that it's rare for that to happen at a young age anyway, so I really just kind of went full throttle with my studies after that, and St. Francis has always been so wonderful to push education, that education is the most important, and that having experienced people also means showing people, you know, that knowledge is power and that you can grow in your position. So yes, I was working here and going to school, and as soon as I graduated, they were wonderful enough to say, we're proud of you, and promote me to assistant winemaker right after I graduated. So I really will be forever appreciative of that.
And then just a short 4 years later, you were promoted again to associate winemaker. So what is exactly the difference between an assistant and an associate winemaker? Like, what are the key responsibilities between those two?
In my mind, being associate winemaker means that you are given a wine or a brand all to yourself, and that it is now your sole responsibility to give directive for that, you know, that wine from start to finish. And what happened when I was promoted is Tom Mackey gave me the Chardonnay program, the whole entire program from the national brand all the way to our direct-to-consumer Chardonnays, and he said, this is your responsibility now. We want to see if you have what it takes to be a winemaker. You can write everything, the program. You can go out and visit the vineyards and make those picking calls. And I think it's really important because people have the viewpoint that being a winemaker is sitting in your at the tank and tasting wine all day, but there's a tremendous amount of responsibility that will forever fall on you once that wine goes to the consumer, out in the market. So you really have to be aware of the decisions that you are making. There's nobody to really turn to when you're a winemaker and say, did I make the right decision? You have to have that confidence in yourself. And I think being associate winemaker, that's the main aspect that people want to see. When you're assistant, you do some of those, but you always have the winemaker to fall back on, or the opinion to that of the winemaker. When you're associate, you are responsible for that wine or that brand.
So that leads in perfectly. So how nervous were you in that first vintage? What vintage was that you took over the Chardonnay, and what did you sleep at night? Were you
I probably definitely did not sleep. I want to say that was 2008. I was incredibly nervous, but at the same time, in those years leading up to it, I took my assistant job very seriously, and I asked a lot of questions. I didn't let my ego get in the way of where I wanted to go, because I felt like I wanted to have enough experience to prove that I was worthy of being promoted when that time came. So when I was assistant, I felt very happy in that position. I worked really hard, and I asked all the questions that I would want to have the answer for. So I felt pretty confident. I felt pretty good.
And was Tom there, like, for if you had questions, he was there to guide you with a gentle hand?
He was, you know. I think definitely during fermentation, since it was my first year really writing the production protocol for fermentation, I would go down and I would let, you know, have Tom taste with me and make sure, just having that little bit of backup. And he's very gracious. And of course, you know, he didn't want to just, you know, kick the little bird out of the nest. But he, I feel like he also kind of knew that that I had it.
Right. I'm sure he wasn't giving that to you without the confidence that you had shown him that you can handle it.
Yeah. Yes.
Absolutely. So I think this is actually a perfect time to, let's talk about this first wine that was sent to me, the Chardonnay. So this is the 2017 Sonoma Coast Chardonnay. And unfortunately, I did not get to taste the wines because they arrived literally a half an hour or so before we sat down. But so tell me about this wine, this harvest, the grapes.
Sure. 2017 vintage was very warm up here in Northern California. We went through three different heat spikes that were about a week long. So that kind of intensified ripening, where I think that in a lot of instances, the sugars were high, but the grape was not physiologically at maturity. So picking decisions were quite difficult that year. But I have to say, it's probably one of my favorite vintages that we've made of Chardonnay in a few years, because of those heat spikes. You have these beautiful, what I call tree fruit kind of aromas and flavors, so pear, apple, peach. But then the acidity is just naturally higher because we picked it a little bit earlier than we would normally. So it's got this great balance. And then we use about 25% new French oak. All of our Chardonnay is fermented in barrel. And we do some stirring of the lees, batonnage, and that just really kind of creates a creamy mouthfeel without adding any extra oak in there.
That's wonderful. 2017, we had the same issue in Paso. We had a heat spike that I think was 10 days long, as opposed to having two heat spikes. We had one long heat spike, and I don't think... I think it was like 10 years or 9 years since Paso had seen a heat spike that long.
It's hotter than usual, right, for you guys? Because you guys are usually elevated temperatures compared to
correct
California as well. So it must have been really hot.
Yeah, it was like 10. And it was the same thing. It happened when, you know, the fruit just wasn't quite ready, you know, to ripen to where you would want it to go. We did have some cooling at nights, but even the cool nights were not what we typically had. So 2017 was not the easiest vintage, but it can make some stellar wines if you're creative and you can move quickly and think on your feet and know the science behind what you can do to help that shine.
Absolutely.
Right. What about your vintages today? When you first started, has anything changed at St. Francis in terms of how you are handling the wines than when you were first starting?
Definitely since I first started. But I think that, you know, probably in the last 8 years or so, we really found a really great, happy medium with what we're doing here, which kind of goes back to creativity. We have a lot of leeway in what we do. We don't try to force a vintage to make a certain kind of wine. We just, we look at every vintage independently, and we give ourselves flexibility in the cellar, and that's the biggest thing that we can do. Our cellar is very spacious, And so it gives us the opportunity in vintages that are very condensed to bring everything in at the same time. Or it also gives us the flexibility to go into vineyards and say, okay, not only do I like this block, but I like this corner of this block, and I think I want to pick that separately. And maybe it's just 2 tons, and that's all we make from that vineyard. But those kinds of winemaking techniques are why I love working at St. Francis, because they give us a tremendous amount of flexibility.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. So, in 2015, you were named Best Woman Winemaker of the Year. So first, yay, congratulations, kudos to that. That is an amazing achievement, but kind of going back to what I had, you know, said earlier about your promotions, how do you feel about the title Best Woman? Do you think that sometime in the future, it's not going to be Best Woman? Because, I mean, we don't hear Best Man Winemaker. You know, right. So, like, it's an honor, but how do you feel about that?
I mean, I think it's definitely a common thread in today's workplace environment across all job positions.
Right. Not even just the winery.
Of course, yes, I would love to see one day where they just say best winemaker and it's the option of a man or a woman. But even myself, I'm still shocked that in Northern California, women who hold the winemaker position only make up a little over 10% of winemakers. So, you know, I think it is going to be a while, and I do like this competition because I think it just continually brings to light all the winemakers in the country that are around. I mean, I think there was over 1,000 entries for that competition. So there's definitely a strong female presence in winemaking, and I just want to keep it in front of everybody's eyes. That's all I can really hope for right now, I think.
That's wonderful. And here's the thing that blows my mind, like you said, that about women across any industry, really, in the United States, you know, it's how we're getting there. There's best woman this and best woman, you know. But the thing that blows my mind is we're supposed to be this new world. We're supposed to be so advanced. We're supposed to be all of this in the United States. And then I'm not putting down at all that, you know, whatever, but like Reyes Baixas, in Spain, they're 58 to 60% female winemakers.
Yep.
And that just blows my mind. And by far, one of my favorite regions on the face of it. I mean, I will drink an Albarino any day of the week. But yeah. Like, that blows my mind that, as you said, where female winemakers are like 10%. And that's a big increase in the last few years.
Yes.
And then you go to Reyes Baixas and it's almost 60%. And that's the only stat I have in my head of other wine countries. But I think we're on the low end of that.
Yeah. I mean, it's in the grand scheme of winemaking history, we haven't been making wine for that long, really. So it doesn't surprise me, although, again, when you look at France, I would expect more women winemakers than we currently see. But I think, you know, definitely for St. Francis, it's pretty incredible that the family that owns St. Francis, which is right now it's owned by three sisters, and all of their American wineries that they've owned have all had female winemakers. And they've always pushed, you know, I mean, they've always pushed just respect in general, but it's pretty amazing to think that even going back to the 70s, these women had the foresight to put a woman in a top position, and I love that.
I love it too. Back to your wines, you're actually now responsible from Just Chardonnay, you're now responsible for the Old Vine Zin, Pinot Noir, and Chardonnay. So how did you go from Chardonnay to those three?
Mm-hmm. Well, when Tom Mackey retired in 2011, we thought that maybe we would look at winemaking a little bit differently than a lot of other wineries, where usually they have a head winemaker and then an assistant or associate. But we kind of looked at it differently, where we wanted to put winemakers in front of varieties that they felt really passionate about. And so, of course, Chardonnay is where I started. I will never let Chardonnay go. And Zinfandel as well, such a passion project of mine. Pinot Noir, I feel like, because Chardonnay, when I started to go visit Burgundy, I came back and I thought, well, if I'm heading up Chardonnay, I have to head up Pinot as well, because I just love that area of France. And then when we looked at the other varieties, it's not that I don't enjoy making them. I've had a lot of fun making all kinds of different varieties. But we found interest in another young winemaker who was working for Beringer. He knew a lot about Bordeaux, and he felt very passionate about them. And so we hired him on and put him in charge of what he's really passionate about, including Sauvignon Blanc. So the two of us, we're very collaborative, and it just keeps our focus on what we love day in and day out.
I personally think that's brilliant. I think that's division of labor, where you can focus in on what your passion is. And where there's Chardonnay, there's Pinot. So they go hand in hand. And in my opinion, by doing this, you can focus in on this, where St. Francis is such a large brand. I think that you wouldn't be able to put your heart and soul into everything that they produce. And this way you really can pour yourself into this segmented section of it. So,
right. I love how this interview kind of has formed a center around this creativity, because really, I feel like if I stretch myself too thin, or Chris Luton stretches himself too thin, then you lose that creative edge on what you love to do. And so this way, believe me, the three of those varieties, it's a lot of work. But I look forward to it, and it feeds my creativity, knowing, like, what am I going to do with Zinfandel this year? What am I going to do with Chardonnay? And excited to make Pinot Noir. It keeps the creativity moving at a very high pace. Rather than like, oh, I can't deal with that right now because I've got five other varieties I have to also work on.
So, perfect segue. Da-da!
Pinot Noir.
Let's talk about Pinot Noir. Looking to be in the know about Dracaena wines? Want to know when we release our new wines? Find out about all of our accolades and get some behind-the-scenes information? Well, all you need to do is sign up for our newsletter. There is no commitment necessary, and I promise you we won't spam your mailbox with loads of messages. Need another reason to sign up? Quite possibly the best reason? You will immediately get a code for a special discount on all of our wines and be privy to newsletter-only specials. Let Dracaena Wines turn your moments into great memories. Sign up simply by heading to our website, DracaenaWines.com, and fill out the pop-up or sidebar. It will take less than a minute of your time, but the rewards will last forever. This is your 2017 Sonoma County Pinot Noir, and 100% Pinot?
It's 100% Pinot.
And is it a blend of clones?
It's a blend of clones, and it's also a blend of different appellations in Sonoma County. Sonoma County is quite large, and you have everything from the coastal appellations that are right near the Pacific to a little bit more inland that can be rather warm. But I think in those warmer areas, you also get this more fruity, high-toned fruit from Pinot Noir that seems to be really popular right now. And it really is my goal to create a Pinot Noir that is at a great price, that's 100% Pinot.
So again, this is more creativity, because you have all of these clones and you have all of these blocks going on. And I'm sure vintage from vintage, even though you're going from vineyard to vineyard, is the same. The ratio of those clones and the ratio of those blocks vary to give, so you can express what you feel is the best Pinot Noir for that vintage.
Yes, and anybody who has ever dealt with Pinot Noir and winemaking, there is very vast clonal differences. So again, you know, I get excited for Harvest for Pinot every year because everything tastes so different in the tank, and you just have to say to yourself, like, what is the blend going to be this year? Is it going to be more spicy sandalwood? Is it going to be more black cherry? I love that part about making Pinot.
So actually, that was going to be my next question. You're fermenting separately and then blending those clones and vineyards together at the final.
Yes, it's probably part of just my obsessive compulsive. I have a hard time combining anything really, because I'm just so curious to see what the vintage has brought us every year. So it can get to be a lot. Usually at the end of harvest, we have about 200 lots fermenting, but it's so fun to go taste in the cellar. That's one of my favorite times, is to get here in the morning and go through and taste all my tanks and see what did this year bring us.
And have you found that certain blocks are always presenting those same or similar characteristics, and you start to find, do you find that this block or this clone and this clone really marriage well together? And
yes. Yeah, I think there's tons of different styles for Pinot, and I don't think that one is better than the other. It has to do with your personal style, your customer base, but you definitely gravitate towards particular clones, and they show the same characteristics year in and year out. So, yeah.
Okay. So the last two wines we have are both Zinfandels. So this one is your old vine Zinfandel. So this is actually 2016. I'm getting old. I had to like move that away a little bit. 2016. So this is your old vine. And then I also have the Zinfandel Dry Creek Valley, which is also 2016. And the first thing I'm noticing is that, oh, this is a reserve. Okay, so I was like, all right, I'm noticing that this is a whole different label here. So this is a reserve. So let's talk about your old vines first. So tell us about what the vines are, where they're located.
Sure. The old vine Zin is really a blend of about 20 different Zin vineyards that we contract with. And the majority of them are anywhere from 80 to 120 years old. So,
wow.
So authentically old. I would say the average is 50, but really we pull from all these different appellations in Sonoma County, and kind of like both the Chard and the Pinot, where you grow Zinfandel really showcases different characteristics. When you grow Zinfandel in the northern counties like Dry Creek, it's more of this black fruit, very opulent type of Zin. Russian River is very spicy. And then down here on the southern end of Sonoma County, I think you really get a combination of more red raspberry fruit with, again, some of that peppery quality to it.
So the youngest is about 50 years, you said. So we had a previous podcast discussing what old vine means. And my first thing, are these head trained?
Yes, the majority are head trained, yes. We are also looking towards the future of Zinfandel. What I've been seeing here in Northern California anyway is a lot of Zinfandel being ripped out to be planted to, varieties that are a little bit more economically feasible for the grower. So we actually just planted our first Zinfandel on one of our estate properties that will be trellised as well.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
But the majority of that what's contracted is head trained, okay. For sure.
So let me get a little geeky here. Why are you deciding to trellis them? What's What is the difference that you see of how that Zinfandel is going to produce by the head training versus a trellis, whichever system you're choosing?
Well, when we look at the future of farming, you know, you see a lot of mechanization, not just because it's easier and cheaper, those are definitely components, but also because the mechanization produces the same quality as hand-picked fruit that we're seeing. So when you put it that way, it becomes more an aspect of managing your canopy, managing your fruit load, and not so much the orientation of your vine itself. Of course, head-trained vines, they're beautiful.
They're romantic.
They're romantic, and I think a lot of their character comes from the fact that they're close to a century years old, and those roots are so deep into the soil. That will eventually come with some of these trellis blocks, but we have to give it time, and we have to look to the future. That's part of our sustainability outlook, is to be here for the future of wine.
So that I was asking because I do another series podcast called Wine for Bet Street. And each month I take a different letter with a friend of mine, Debbie G. Aquindo. We take a different letter each month and then we research it and we present an educational series on it. And we just completed our first season, and it was obviously Z. So we did Zinfandel. And what I actually learned was that the only reason why they're head trained back then was because there was not enough wire or wood back then to create trellises. And all right, well, we can't make trellises. We're going to go here. So it's not necessarily that Zinfandel needs to be head trained, but yeah, it is romanticized as that way. But it was literally lack of production material.
It was. And I think that, you know, I get that question too about watering. You know, they say, oh, well, you know, they don't water old head-trained vineyards. And I say, well, it's because it hasn't had water for 100 years, so you're not going to start watering it. But what we know about agriculture now, what we know about farming now, is that, you know, that you can create high-quality vineyards and sometimes even better quality for longer if you start your vineyard out correctly with irrigation. It doesn't mean you have to, you know, water it like it's ivy. It just means that if the vine is going to tell you that it needs water, you can give it some water.
Right. Okay, so why don't we compare and contrast what the characteristics between your old vines in, and I guess that's really an unfair question since this is a reserve and from Dry Creek Valley specifically, but let's try. Let's compare and contrast the two.
Sure. So the old vines in, you will find in your local marketplace. The reserve Dry Creek Zin, first of all, it's only from Dry Creek Valley. So a much, much smaller appellation, just one appellation instead of, I think the Zinfandel encompasses about five appellations. But the reserve in Dry Creek is mainly going to be found in high-end restaurants and retail shops, small wine shops. So that was really the focus, and it's much smaller case production. It only comes from two vineyards out in Dry Creek Valley as opposed to 20 that the old vines in blends together.
But all are available at the tasting room?
Yes. Both are available in the tasting room as we speak.
Okay. And the combination between the two, or the comparison between the two, would you say the reserve is a little, since it's coming specifically from Dry Creek, is it a little bit more peppery? Is it less peppery? Is it a little more finesse? What do you see?
I'd say that the Dry Creek Reserve Zin is it's kind of the more brambly Zins. You get a lot of like blackberry pie, a lot of vanillin from the oak that we use in that wine, whereas the old vine Zin definitely has that classic peppery quality and more raspberry notes, I think.
The old school, old thought of Zinfandel.
Right.
Awesome. Okay, so let's go back and let's talk about the winery itself for a bit. So St. Francis was named after the protector of animals and the natural world. So in 1971, Joe Martin and his wife Emma purchased the property. They chose to name it St. Francis. So there's a lot of saints out there. There's a lot of things. Why St. Francis?
Well, Joe was very faithful to his faith, the Catholic faith. And really, it's as simple as his favorite patron saint was Saint Francis of Assisi. He also had a keen interest in the missions here in California, so he knew he wanted to eventually have a winery that looked somewhat like a mission, and he decided to name it Saint Francis after Saint Francis of Assisi.
And I did read you guys actually do a blessing of the animals. Right?
Yes, we have our local priest come visit us in October, and we invite the whole entire community to bring whatever animal they feel like, and we'll bless it and give them a nice blessing for the rest of the year and beyond.
That's wonderful. I love it. Vegas is sleeping over here, not at all budget, but we took him one time to go be blessed, and it's a nice experience. It really is.
Yeah, it's definitely a community event, and we love to see everybody, and we've seen everything from, of course, cats and dogs, but we've seen parrots and gerbils. One year there was a camel.
There you go. I was going to say, what was your strangest animal?
The camel was definitely pretty strange.
Where is he staying? Like,
I don't know.
You guys have the riding trails and stuff. One day you're walking around and you see a camel.
I'll say, there he is.
Ah! That's hysterical. So when they first started, when St. Francis first started, for like their first 8 years, they actually just sold fruit. So
yes.
Was that just as they were building up their vineyards? Because you said they've always wanted to have the winery, so.
I think in the beginning, Joe just wasn't really sure what the transition would be. He started growing those grapes at the original Beeler Ranch and selling them to local wineries. And it's really when they were starting to get good medals and write-ups from that original vineyard that Joe kind of said to himself, I think we can make it if we build ourselves a little winery here. So he did.
Why should we be letting them get the awards on our fruit? Let's do this ourselves.
Exactly.
One of, I think, the most obvious or predominant part about your winery is that bell tower.
Yes.
And you can see it from far away, and you can hear it from even further away. And from the first time we pulled up and our first tasting at St. Francis, I fell in love with the winery. I love the mission concept of it. It's beautiful. But that bell tower is, if anybody is listening or watching who has not seen this, I'm sure you can Google it. I'm sure you can whatever, and the pictures are there. It's magnificent. And what's the history behind that?
You know, I have to give it to Joe. He was really like a go big or go home kind of guy. And when we built this facility that we're currently at in the winery, the tasting room, in the late 90s, he wanted it to be extra special. So he actually commissioned the bell to be made by the Marinelli family, which has been making bells for the Vatican since the 1300s. They're actually the oldest family-owned business in Italy. And I'm pretty sure it probably cost him more to ship it back to America than to build it. But it's so beautiful. It's really stunning. And he went all the way over there to make sure that it was made and inscribed with St. Francis of Assisi on the bell. And it does ring every hour on the hour.
So that blows my mind that like, let's make this bell in Italy. And I don't know how heavy it is, but it's
about 1,000 pounds.
Yeah, it's enormous and it's solid. And when it rings, you can feel it in your soul when it rings. But I think you have to be right. It had to have cost an outrageous amount to ship that. And I mean, I don't know how, do you know how long it took to get made and to ship it? Like,
I don't. I mean, that's a great question. I mean, obviously, it probably had to come over by boat in a container. But in the 90s, who knows? Especially from Italy, it could have taken months.
Months. Right. Okay, so as I was showing the wines, we know about the Reserve, and then the other labels are all the same white label. But you, St. Francis actually has four different tiers: the Icon, the Artisan, the Reserve, and the Classic. So what's the difference between those tiers, and then how do you decide what fruit goes into what tier, because you're picking all from the same places?
Right. I think the main difference between them is going to be accessibility. So the Classic series, you know, as we mentioned before, you'll find that all over the country at your local marketplace.
So that's like the old vine.
Yep. And we also have Cab, Merlot, Sauvignon Blanc, and Chardonnay, and Pinot in that white label Classic series.
Okay.
With the Reserve line that we saw the Zinfandel earlier from Dry Creek, we also have Cabernet and Merlot in that label. And those are available all over the country, just kind of focused more in restaurants and wine shops.
And they all have the same color scheme?
Yeah, kind of a grayish label, if you will.
Okay. And then the Icon and Artisan?
The Artisan are the wines that you, both the Artisan and the Icon wines, you will only find here at the winery or on our website, www.stfranciswinery.com. The Artisan series is available at the tasting room and for our wine club. And they focus on both vineyard designates and proprietary blends that Chris and I both like to make. And then the Icon series are specifically blended wines what we call the winemaker wines. So very, very small case production, really only available at the winery so far. And they're a little bit different vintage to vintage because we really kind of have to wait to see what the year is going to bring us. But I think one thing that I love about the way we make wine is we give everybody the chance to be in any of those tiers each year, which is why we kind of ferment everything separately. We see what the year gave us, what each lot tastes like, and then we kind of whittle it down to from the Icon series to the Classic. But what a lot of people don't know is that, you know, we make wine for the wine club for a certain amount, and some of these vineyard designates also go in to the Classic wine. So it's not that our best vineyards are being made for the Icon series. It's just that we're selecting those as something special, but usually pieces of them kind of trickle down to the Classic wines, and we love that. We love showcasing that we can make an everyday drinking wine made from exceptional vineyards.
And although I haven't tasted these wines, I have tasted a lot of St. Francis wines, and I can vouch for that. Each wine tends to have its own little character, which is what I think makes good wine. Because if everything tastes the same, then why are you drinking it? Why are you having different labels? Why are you having that? And I think that St. Francis really works hard to make sure that each bottle that you're, or each, you know, type that you're drinking has its own little characteristic. And as you said, it might not be the same vintage to vintage, but again, I don't want it tasting the same vintage to vintage, you know, then you're adding stuff, you know, that wonderful purple, you know, all that stuff, you know, but we won't go there. So the other thing that I love about St. Francis is that you are actually certified sustainable, and you have 400 acres that is actually certified sustainable between what you have in the Sonoma Valley and the Russian River. So it's an extensive process to go through. So I can't imagine how mind-boggling it is to have that many acres be certified. I know a lot of wineries have smaller lots or smaller, you know, blocks that are certified, but you guys are 400 acres. So why is that so important that you guys go through all of that rigmarole to get that?
Well, I think it's been a really eye-opening experience, something we've been working on for close to a decade. But for us, sustainability makes sense because it really looks at a holistic view of our business. So it's not just about the way we grow grapes and the way we make wine. Those are certainly very important aspects and a big part of sustainability to get certified. But we're also looking at, like, social equity. How are we treating our employees? And just basic economics. You know, is our infrastructure solid enough to last us for the future? Those are things that really constitute actual sustainability. Because if you can't foresee your winery being here in 10, 20, 30 years, you're not sustainable. And you kind of defeated the purpose. So, you know, looking at how we've improved in the vineyard by just taking incredibly small steps, like, you know, measuring how much water we use. We've cut our water usage by 30%, just knowing that we were putting too much in the vineyard and the vines weren't taking it all up. Some of it was just going right out. And then, of course, you know, our solar panels on the winery, it's amazing to see how those big things make a difference. But also, you know, our employees, from the vineyard workers to the CEO, everybody has the same 401k plan. Everyone has the same vacations. Because if your employees are going to stay with you for 10, 20, 30 years, you're going to have a business to work on for 10 to 20, 30 years. And that's also incredibly important to us.
You don't want to, if you have to keep retraining people, you can't advance as a company.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, this will be my 18th harvest, and that's really nothing. We have guys here that have been here 25, 30 years that helped plant the original Beeler Vineyard. I think it really says something about our company. And I think that's why when we looked at sustainability, there's a really big section on social equity, and we loved that for our business model as a winery.
And you also have done something with your packaging, right? You're using recycled packaging?
Yes, we use as much recycled packaging as possible.
Because the glass, and this is not a negative, I have to preface that, it's not heavy glass.
Correct.
And I cannot get over why people feel that, oh, this is a heavy bottle, this must be a good wine. I don't get that. Because in all reality, if you're buying a heavy bottle of wine, all you're doing is paying more for the shipping.
Right? I know. I think it must come back to the original molds. When people used to do, like, hand molds for glass, those molds were quite thick. And so the glass was thick, and it was a heavier wine. That's the only thing I can really think of. But we try to keep a somewhat lightweight glass, and, you know, our corks are also recyclable. You can throw your cork in the green bin of your house, the compost bin as well. So we try to do as much recycling as we possibly can. Yeah, thank
Kudos.
You.
Kudos. Well, we're reaching about an hour. And so before we go to my game, did I miss anything that you feel you want to talk about either the wines or about St. Francis or about yourself?
I don't think so. It's been so nice to talk to another winemaker.
Ah. Thank you. And I have to honestly say, I was not, you know, I saw the dates and things, but I wasn't putting two and two together. So when I first saw you, I was kind of blown away by how young you are.
Well, I started really young.
But you've accomplished so much, and it's wonderful. I mean, this is like my third career winemaking. I started in the lab, left the lab, doing the winery, still have a full-time job on top of the winery, hopefully just for a couple more years. But I have to honestly say, I'm so honored to sit here and speak to you, to share your story, because you have accomplished so much. And I think you show what can be done if you just follow your passion. If you pursue your passion, man, the sky is the limit.
Yeah, I think following your passion, doing what you love, it may take a while, but, you know, then when you look back, you have all this experience, and there's nothing that can feel better than that.
Great. So before we play the game, I just want you to shout out. You did mention the winery, but where are you also on social media so people can find St. Francis Winery? And if you're personal, I don't know if you want to share personal, if you're on there.
We are definitely on both Facebook and Instagram, and I believe it is just St. Francis Winery, but it's St. Francis Winery, either by Facebook or at Instagram.
Okay, and stfranciswinery.com or just?
Yes.
Okay.
www.stfranciswinery.com.
Wonderful. And they can order all of these wines on the website?
If they are still available, they can go online and see what is the current availability. But there's tons of wines to choose from on the website.
Okay. Wonderful. All right. So you ready for the game?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm just going to say those two terms. You tell me whichever pops in your head first is whichever one you like better. Okay? We're going to start off with non-wine terms, and then we'll go to wine terms. Okay?
Okay.
All right. So night or day?
Night.
Sunset or sunrise?
Ooh, sunset.
Black or white?
Black.
Walk or run?
Hawk.
Food or drink?
Drink.
Old world, new world?
Old world.
Sweet or dry?
Dry.
Bubbles or still?
Oh, man, that's the hardest. I'm going to have to go with still.
Start with bubbles, end with still. How's it?
Right.
Oak or stainless?
Oak, definitely.
Drink now or drink later?
Drink later.
Blend or varietal?
Varietal.
Vintage or non-vintage?
Vintage.
Cork or screw cap?
Cork.
Napa or Sonoma?
Oh, man. Sorry, friends on the other side. I got to stay with my Sonoma boots.
Commercial or indigenous?
Ooh, indigenous.
Bordeaux or Rhone?
Oh,
no. Warm climate or cool climate?
Cool climate.
And that's it.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
A little Phoebe game.
That's so great.
Thanks. I always love hearing it, and I say it for people who listen to the podcast, they're going to hear it again, so just fast forward 15 seconds. But the psychology thing is generally people who choose night stick to sunset and black, and the people who choose day stick to sunrise and white.
I think it has something to do with, like, people that are, like, morning person or evening person.
Maybe. Yeah, could be. I mean, I am the definite sunset. Like, I admit sunrises are beautiful, but I would rather keep, you know, I think the only time my eyes see sunrise is at harvest time.
Well, it's coming up.
I know. Have you picked anything yet? Your sub or St. Francis?
Friday?
Yeah,
we have some Sauvignon Blanc coming in, and then Chardonnay on the books for next week.
Okay. Well, best of luck with the harvest, and congratulations on all that you've done. And for, I mean, really, the accomplishments are amazing. And all I can say is that I know I'm going to be hearing more about you in the future, because there's going to be great things still coming from you. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I really, really appreciate it.
Okay. Have a wonderful day, evening. Best of luck with the harvest, and we will talk soon.
Bye.
This has been another episode of Exploring the Wine Glass. Thanks for listening. If you have suggestions on what topics you would like me to discuss, please reach out on social media. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as Exploring the Wine Glass. I'm also on LinkedIn as Lori Hoytbud. Of course, you can always email me at exploringthewineglass@gmail.com. If you enjoyed our podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast catcher to help others find me more easily. Until next week, Sláinte.